Accession number 30493, Reel 5.
1941 was like, though there wasn't a civilians and soldiers, we were a nation under threat. Churchill was able to sort of epitomise that because, my God, half the country hated Churchill, you know. Churchill had used troops in times of peace four times before the war broke out, four times. Now, that went into the folk memory of millions of English people, British people. He turned... He ordered... There was a strike in Liverpool in 1887, I think it was, and Churchill had a battleship. He had a battleship turn up in Liverpool Harbour with its guns trained on the city. How many people know that? It's in the history books. And then, of course, there was the siege of Sydney Street. And there was Churchill out. They called the army out. And the army fired, and a couple of anarchists were killed. Now, that was all unnecessary. They should have been brought to trial properly. Captured. Surely you know two guys in a house. He turns the army out for it. Now, and then there's a general strike. So that was defeated after a terrible week, 9 days, which everybody, the miners stuck it out with their families. Churchill, the press closed down, In sympathy, the printing workers, newspapers didn't come. Churchill set up his own paper, the British Gazette, and wrote these fierce editorials about the criminals in the coal mines. It was an unforgettable week, you see, for not. I mean, that was. I have only discovered all that in later years, you see. I mean, I was a teenager, not much aware of what was going on. But there we are. There was Neville in the war. The nation accepted Churchill because he came out with the right words at the right time. No doubt about that.
Did you at the time then have
sorry?
Did you at the time then have particularly strong feelings one way or the other?
No, I was seen. There's another story about Nottingham. This is quite significant, actually. I'd looked up my diary for that year. It's very scanty, but I mentioned the having to pick up the paper all around the city. Then I mentioned the fact that a new guy's moved in with me in the billet we were in. We were billeted in civilian houses or properties, and I say, oh, this guy's a red-hot socialist. Now, that's very significant, that entry, I think, in my political development, because he was only there a few days, but I must have come out with a few naive statements about, I might have volunteered, and he sort of laughed at me and asked me why I should volunteer, if I was going to be called up. He ridiculed me, and that led to, a sort of fierce... discussion in which he put forward a socialist image, you see, which I'd been totally ignorant of. I think he probably told me Churchill's true record. And anyway, just in 2 or 3 days, he stirred up in me some doubts about, shall I say, my not conservative view, because I'd been reading the Daily Mirror, and it was certainly not a conservative paper, and it was a paper that really was an anti-fascist paper and supported Churchill's anti-fascist stance at the late 30s. So that was very significant, because my gradual awareness of politics and history, that now that grew and grew and grew and grew, and to this day.
With those new guns that you'd just received in Yorkshire, could you explain the stages involved in laying and firing the 25
We became very well-trained soldiers, you know. I might have said this before. I think we were one of the best trained armies in the world. Because actual fighting actually continued to elude us. So, right, guns on, with the guns on Yorkshire Moors, exercises. This is where we learned that the gun was the Holy Grail. This had to be defended, had to be cleaned and maintained, and you could be exhausted and worn out at the end of the days across the Yorkshire Moors under all kinds of weather conditions. When you came back muddy and tired and just aching to get into your blankets, the gun had to be spotless before you did. Now that was drummed into us. I mean, the army, they're so skilled at drumming into you by constant repetition. Repetition, that's the curse of the army. Marching, drilling, bullshitting, that's the perfect word for it all. So you gradually got used to all that, but you have to admit that this army method, it does turn out well-trained soldiers, and it's done with not the Prussianness and the bullying that the Americans use. The Americans have adopted these awful Prussian, German, brutal methods of brutalizing their troops. I don't think there's any doubt about that. The Americans, and I've got some very interesting comments I discovered in my diaries about what we thought. Oh, and also in the regimental history, there's some very significant passages about what we thought about. When we met up, we relieved the Americans, you see, at one battlefront in the mountains. And each side was amazed at the other. The Americans of us and us of the Americans. What was the question you started with?
The actual stages.
Yes. Well, can I say there's just six guys to each gun, and each one learns the skill of all the others. I mean, number one is the sergeant. He's in charge. You don't do anything before he's passed on the messages, which usually come over a tannoy from the command post. And he will pass on the orders, the range, the angle of sight. And the number three guys got there with this instrument of the size of a 25-pounder. And on this instrument, he will set the degrees, the angle of degree, the range. And then there are two little bubbles, or level, I forgot what you call them, the little bubbles that have to be level. And it's very important that you do go through a sequence of actions on this instrument to get it absolutely, get the gun barrel absolutely aligned accurately. It is absolutely essential. And just occasionally, we would, later on in the war in Italy, we were reprimanded. Not so much reprimanded, we were warned that shells had hit our own men. And that's a terrible thing for the artilleryman. The gunner is ashamed. Well, like all soldiers are when they kill their own people, kill their own side. It happens. A friendly fire, it's called. It's a lovely term for it. You've just slaughtered some people who are fighting on your side. So you really, if you were number three, you really had to be good at it. Although all six of you will have been able to do three, so some guys were more, shall we say, fastidious or more careful than others and proved to be better at it. So they would usually get that. The one who was best at it would usually get number three. Now, I was often number three, and the biggest compliment a gunner can get is a message from the command post comes down over the tunnel, and the sergeant relays it, and they say, he says, I've congratulated. Sometimes, you see, it's just one gun, it's a ranger's gun. So you know that you've got to be accurate. The officer in the observation post is looking at the target, and he makes a guess of the distance and the angle, and he passes it back, and you put on those measurements, and the shell leaves the gun. The observation officer watches where it lands, and then sends back corrections to the command post, which pass to the sergeant, and then to number three. So you might have one shell that goes too far, then another one that goes too far to the left. I mean, if you might say the target might be a house, and then the shell might fall to the right. You might fire six shells before you actually hit the house. But by stroke of luck and the skill of the observation post officer, you might, by luck and skill, hit that house with the very first shell. And at least on one occasion, congratulations came back, and I was the one on number three, and I had hit the house because I accurately laid the gun, and was congratulated for it. That happened two or three times, I suppose. The targets are often quite absurd, you know. A group of sunbathing Germans target. I used to feel a bit sick sometimes about that. I don't know. And in my diary, I came across the passage, what a dirty business it is, you know. Dispatch rider along the road, and you plant a few shells in his way, you know. And some people, you know, a couple of Germans sunbathing, for God's sake. Four devils, I will write, look, in the diary. So I was very conscious of, you know, who was at the other end and getting damaged. But there we are. It takes a lot of training before six people know everything to do on a gun. And by that time, you're a real team. This is when you're all dependent on one another. It's the dependency that creates the comradeship in the end, you know. I hear stories coming back from Iraq, and I can visualise what it's like out there. Ever since 1945, every war that's come along, I've been in it. Now, you know, 7 years in the army as a professional, I regarded myself as I volunteered, I was a professional soldier. And ever since, I have looked at wars and read about them and criticised them. And I don't think there's a single war since 1945 I think could have been avoided. I read the other day, I've forgotten the chap who writes, it's an investigative journalist. He says, America has bombed 30 countries since 1945. Now, the average man in the street has to think hard to think of, three or four? 30? They resort to bombing at a drop of a hat. They believe in bombing because they think it saves their own men's lives. The Americans aren't good in war, you know. They're not. Initially, we thought they were sloppy. They're brave. Of course they're brave men in every war. They're wearing every uniform. Some of the bravest a lot were the Germans. My God, it's in my diary. I said, how do they live under this rain of steel with this pulverize them? My diary records 400 bombs. I said one day we saw the American bombers go over, and I said, the sky's black with them. And because they weren't always heading to Italian battlefields, well, they were heading off to Bulgaria and Romania and Hungary to drop their bombs. But the superiority in the air was total in Italy. Although my diary there again records Germans, well, they hit our regimental headquarters from the air and caused casualties. That's in my diary. I don't remember it. It's there in my diary. And I do remember Messerschmitt. We were on the road, on the move, and this Messerschmitt just roared out over our heads. It seemed to be about 6 feet over our heads. And so they had, there was a remnant of a German air force, and they dared to sneak out now and again, but the air was dominated by the Americans and the British. The Spitfires would come roaring in, and you'd see them dive, we see them ahead of us, diving there, diving down to all the flak, zooming away. It's a strange life, I must say. You had to be a professional soldier and stick it out. At the same time, in my diary, it's quite clear, I just hated it all. Hated it all. Yeah.
What was there in the way of theoretical training for the gunnery?
Well, we got a lot of lectures. A lot of lectures. There'd be some people who'd be come from other units and talk about various aspects of the war. And I tell you, really, different to my diary, sometimes I'm so well informed, I just can't believe it, you know. Here I was a gunner who had all these duties to carry out. Where did I get all this information? I mean, there's a description, for instance, one of Hitler's crack regiments came opposite us. The Panzergrenadiers had a terrific record. They fought in Russia and all over Europe. And they must have got smashed up a lot, but when it was re-equipped, it was sent into Italy, and there it was right opposite us, this crack Nazi division, the Grenadiers. And in the diary is a full description of their what they were equipped with, how many tanks, guns. I just don't know where it came from. It's just as though I was in the command post, you know, taking with the officers, getting all the information. But somehow or other, I was extremely well informed, and the diary is full of troop dispositions and who was on our left and our right. A lot of it, I think it was Montgomery who revolutionised when he came to head the 8th Army. It was the turning point of the war, really. His new idea. He was a First World War, he'd been in the First World War as a young officer. And he was a really big-headed general, absolute total confidence in his viewpoint. But he, you know, you talk about leadership, and he had, I think Churchill spotted him and saw it as a fellow magnetic leader, you know. And he would he came round to us at least twice, I suppose. That was in Egypt, in Al-Mawza training camp, and we all paraded, and he stood in the jeep and delivered this soldierly message to the troops, you know. But you needed it badly, you know, you needed somebody like that. But he ensured, I think, that the troops were informed about what they should expect, who was opposite, who they were fighting for. He had very sensible ideas. about that. Another interesting thing, because he always dressed casually. Now, the troops love that, you know. These spit and polish generals who look like the equivalent of Nazi generals with all their shiny badges. He discarded all that. I think he wore an Australian hat and a scarf. And as a result, the Eighth Army officers suddenly sort of didn't ape the general officer, the GOC, the general officer commanding, but dress rules were relaxed, and they loved to have sheepskin top coats. Now, I mean, you know, we regard the Middle East as a place of unbearable heat, but at night it's unbearable cold. And the more sheepskin you can get, if you're lucky enough to afford one, and all the officers could, and they did. And the result was, at some opportune moments, for instance, when we landed in Italy at Taranto Harbour, there was a terrific cock-up, and we were all sort of standing, we'd come off the ship, and nothing was waiting for us, not hot food or hot drink. It was just bloody awful shambles. And in fact, I've spotted that in the regimental history. So why is it that when troops move to another place, there isn't a party waiting for them, you know? And the officers there were with us, and they sort of herded together, and they bored them, and as we were. But you could hear, suddenly the cry would be going up, bah, 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 and suddenly all the troops would go, bah, to show their impatience to these sheep-clad officers. I mean, normally you'd be clapped in the guardhouses, but of course collectively you could express yourself, and that was it. Quite often later on, whenever an officer showed up with his sheepskin, it was bah, bah.
What sort of consistency did the guns have in terms of if they were kept?
You're interested in the technical side of things.
If the aiming and everything was left as it between two shots.
Yes.
How regular would the result be, or be expected to be?
I don't quite understand that question.
Well, if the angle and
yes.
The muzzle and so on,
yes.
was left, to say, between two shots,
yes.
would you expect the shell to land in the same place? How?
Well, the point is, the ranging gun establishes for the... it all turns on the officer in the observation post. Now, he's undercover, he's hidden somewhere, hopes he is anyway, and he's observing how close, well, you don't know. And they get as close as possible, dangerously close. I mean, one of my hairiest experiences was I went up with the... I spent a week in the observation post, so I've got a long... I've got good memory of that, actually. But more or less it matches with what's in my diary. So I can give a good picture of what it's like in an observation post. The officer, well, he develops his skill. I mean, well, of course, he's got all his instruments. I mean, he's got, he's got his maps. He knows how many feet above ground. I mean, we might be back 4,000 yards, or we might be in a valley, and his target is several hundred feet up. So he would all work all that out on his maps, you see. So his angle of fire would be determined then. And distance, I wasn't in on that. I had the opportunity quite early on. I'm not sure where. I was asked to go on a course for, and I've forgotten what they call it, on the technical side of it, to become... if I'd said yes, I'd have been up there in an observation post as a non... I'd have got a stripe, of course. And I would have been an NCO in the observation post with the officer. And actually, I would learn the ropes. I mean, if the officer, as they often... Well, they often, but occasionally, he'd be hit. And it was then the duty of the NCO to carry on observing and sending back orders. And of course, there was one occasion when our poor bloody officer had to be put in the back room and bleed to death. And this sergeant had the courage to go on. Passing orders back to the guns. Now, I don't think it was cowardice that made me refuse that job. I just said, and it was true, I said, "I'm sorry, sir, I'm just no good at mathematics." That was perfectly true. I just hated mathematics at school. And being a, I haven't got the language really, you had to learn the whole process of surveying, you know, and use of surveying instruments, and that was it. I suppose I was a master at that, really. But I didn't want to. I said, "I'm sorry, sir, I like to stay on the guns." That was my sort of right way through, I would say. For instance, I was offered a leave in Florence. A week's leave came up. "Great week in Florence for you. Sorry, sir, I want to spend Christmas with the lads. I don't mind going off in a week or two." I wanted to spend Christmas in the front line. And there's quite a nice account of it in my diary, how we stuck out Christmas. In fact, it's interesting. Last Christmas with the family, I thought I'd make it special, and I dug out from my diary and records where I'd spent Christmas in 1945. And I read out these descriptions at the dining table, and everybody fell silent. And my younger daughter, she's 40 now, I think, she said, "Oh, thanks, Dad, for doing that." How I spent four or five Christmases in the army, and quite a range of, but it was always celebrated wherever you were. Another interesting thing I came across was I sensed that there was you heard about a truce in the Western Front in the First World War. There's a whole literature about it, I think. Did it happen? Did it not? Witnesses, yes, no. The idea of the Germans and the English kicking a football around in the middle of the Western Front on Christmas Day, well, I suppose it could have happened. But initially there, winter of 1944, in my diary, can there be an unofficial truce going on? You know, there's still a bit of shell fire going on between us, but it all seems very half-hearted. And I think, really, both sides were thinking about Christmas and weren't being very enthusiastic about firing guns and shells at each other.